Lecture 21, Later Mughal Emperors.
The Mughal Empire expanded across South Asia during the 16th and 17th centuries to become one of the largest, wealthiest, and most potent states in the history of the world to that point. Much of its power and authority resulted from Emperor Akbar's innovations. Akbar conquered North India, incorporated many Hindu regional rulers and subjects, created a more effective administration than anything India had ever seen before, and developed a widely engaging imperial culture. However, Akbar's successors each reigned in his own imperial style. Emperor Jahangir elaborated on Akbar's accomplishments, ever desirous of exceeding his father. Next, Emperor Shah Jahan constructed the most sophisticated and impressive manifestations of Mughal glory, including the jewel-encrusted peacock throne, the Taj Mahal, and the walled city of Shah Jahanabad, now famous as Old Delhi. In this lecture, we'll consider these two great Mughal emperors. In future lectures, we'll look at the later Mughal Empire and the challenges to it by other rising empires, Indian and foreign. The transition from one ruler to the next poses great dangers for any empire. Mughal emperors needed sons, but then emperors had to fear that they would be prematurely displaced by one of them. Meanwhile, the various imperial princes knew that only one of them would win the throne, and that the others would be killed during the succession war. By 1569, Emperor Akbar had already ruled for over a dozen years, but he still lacked an heir. He had dozens of wives, but all of his offspring had died soon after birth. Only after making a pilgrimage to the sanctuary of a famous Sufi holy man did Akbar's most senior Rajput wife become pregnant with the future Emperor Jahangir. The Mughal imperial family always considered this first surviving son to be a miraculous child and probable heir, although his succession was by no means certain. He had two younger half-brothers who also sought the throne. As Akbar's reign extended to nearly half a century, ambitious Prince Jahangir was already in his early 30s and impatient to inherit. Fortunately for him, his rival brothers both died prematurely, officially of alcoholism, but there were rumors that they were killed by Jahangir. In 1599, Jahangir threw off his father's authority and established himself as an independent emperor based in Allahabad. For 5 years, he ruled there while Akbar reigned 300 miles up the Ganges River in Agra. Throughout his long reign, Akbar had become ever more religiously heterodox. Many conservative Sunni Muslim generals, officials, and scholars supported Jahangir against allegedly heretical Akbar. Jahangir even arranged the assassination of Akbar's closest confidant, the historian Abul Fazl. Jahangir gleefully received the severed head and rewarded the assassin lavishly. While the armies of the father and son threatened each other, the women of the imperial family sought to smooth over their differences. Finally, as Emperor Akbar lay dying, his rebellious son Jahangir reluctantly begged his forgiveness, accepted a short and symbolic punishment, and was recognized as the official heir. After Jahangir finally acceded to the throne in 1605, he determined to make his reign even more glorious than his father's. He wrote in his personal journal how he chose his regnal name, quote, "The labor of the emperor is world domination, so I name myself Jahangir, world Caesar." He also took the additional title of honor, Nuruddin, light of religion, quote, "Inasmuch as my sitting on the throne coincided with the rising and shining on the earth of the great light, the sun," unquote. Jahangir inherited vast wealth, but he expended it through lavish acquisitions and innovations. The new emperor raised the income of many imperial officials and even the allowances to his womenfolk. He gave grants to many Sunni scholars and holy men. Jahangir evidently had no planned budget and soon created an annual deficit that depleted Akbar's well-stocked treasury. Over the years, Jahangir innovated creatively. He redefined imperial weights and measures, which required the recalculation of all official accounts. In his 13th regnal year, he wrote, quote, "It entered my mind that each month a coin will be struck. The figure of that month's astrological constellation would be on one face, as if the sun were emerging from it. This usage is my own and has never been practiced until now." Close quote. Additionally, he commissioned coins portraying himself holding a wine glass. He also increased by 20% the size of silver coins minted for general circulation, which disrupted the economy. Indeed, even Jahangir realized that he had overreached there. So after 6 years, he restored the official coinage to Akbar's standards. Jahangir personally kept a Persian language diary, Tuzuki Jahangiri. Since Jahangir evidently never revised it, his journal richly documents his changing moods, attitudes, and condition. For example, he candidly describes his alcohol and opium addictions and their increasingly debilitating effects. By age 26, he wrote that his hands trembled excessively, so he needed someone to bring his cup to his lip. He then recorded his slow withdrawal to a lower daily consumption of drugs and wine. In addition to documenting the business of the empire, he repeatedly lauded his own masterful expertise over the fine arts, natural sciences, and theology. As prince and then emperor, Jahangir patronized a large staff of expert painters. He commissioned art both for its own aesthetic sake and also as political propaganda. Jahangir preferred naturalistic and direct representations, having himself portrayed as a peaceful and serene ruler, engaged in spiritual rather than worldly concerns. Jahangir's atelier featured exceptional artistic refinement and high-quality materials. Using sumptuous colors and occasional gilding, many commentators regard this period as a peak of the Mughal miniature tradition. Jahangir also celebrated his own connoisseurship of both aesthetics and technique. Indeed, he tested his artistic knowledge against that of his visitors, including the English ambassador, Sir Thomas Rowe. Rowe, perhaps diplomatically, failed to match Jahangir's expertise. Jahangir also used fine art to depict his primacy over other rulers and enemies. Iranian, Ottoman Turkish, English, and other monarchs appear in his paintings as his attendants or inferiors. Jahangir proclaimed, quote, "Although he is the king of India in outward appearance, inwardly he is the emperor of the world by right and heritage," close quote. Jahangir's painters also featured him embodying divine light. They portrayed him symbolically slaying poverty, although such artwork alone did little for his many poor subjects. Throughout his life, Jahangir acquired natural rarities embellished by his workshops into fine objects for his pleasure. Officials and foreign diplomats learned that offering precious objects would attract Jahangir's favor. When he acquired a rare flower, fruit, or animal, he had it documented in paintings. For instance, he commissioned a precisely detailed painting of a North American turkey imported via Goa. Jahangir sometimes had unusual animals dissected to enhance his knowledge of natural principles. He intended his possession of such works of man and nature to symbolically reveal his mastery over the entire world. Jahangir also made himself the spiritual guide for his officials. Some received initiation into an imperial cult, symbolized by his bestowal to each of them of his miniature portrait, which they wore on their breast or turban. Reportedly, Jahangir then mystically appeared to his disciples in visions and dreams, curing them of illness, even when they were hundreds of miles away. Junkyard quizzed men from various religions, often posing provocative questions and pitting theologians against each other. For instance, Portuguese Jesuits were a small but constant presence at his court. They recorded how Junkyard probed their beliefs about Jesus and his miracles. Junkyard was clearly bemused by the explanations of monastic celibacy and the Catholic concept of the Holy Trinity. But in 1610, he permitted Jesuits to baptize three of his own nephews. The Jesuits saw this as Junkyard's gradual acceptance of Catholicism. But some later historians explain that this may have been a way for Junkyard to disqualify those disfavored nephews from imperial succession. Europeans also affected the empire through increasing intercontinental trade. They imported vast amounts of silver and gold originally extracted from the Americas. With this money, they purchased Indian-made textiles and other products. This initially strengthened the Mughal economy. Indian farmers soon adopted crops from the Americas. These included corn, chili peppers, potatoes, tomatoes, and tobacco. Indeed, Indian tobacco production for local use and export expanded rapidly. As tobacco pipe smoking spread, Junkyard banned it for his courtiers, except for those who were incurable addicts, because of what he described as, quote, the disturbance that tobacco brings about in most temperaments and constitutions. Junkyard prided himself on his bow and musket shooting, a family tradition. At age 47, he boasted that he had personally shot 17,167 birds and beasts so far. Junkyard also continued his family's Central Asian martial tradition of erecting towers of the severed heads of defeated enemies. However, while Junkyard's armies achieved victories in all directions, many newly conquered territories were never fully integrated administratively. This resulted in an ever more sprawling empire. Like his father, Junkyard needed to rely on Hindu Rajput generals, but he appointed no Hindus to high offices at the imperial center, and only a few as provincial governors. Still, Junkyard respected his own Rajput mother, and he married at least 5 Rajput wives, in addition to about 14 Muslim women. But Junkyard was devoted only to his final wife, who evidently dominated his final decade of his reign. Amazingly, she had been a 35-year-old widow of a minor official. She had joined Jahangir's stepmother's household. Somehow, in 1611, she caught 42-year-old Jahangir's eye. Within months, he married and entitled her Nur Mahal, Light of the Palace, echoing his own title, Nuruddin. In Jahangir's memoirs, she receives increasing praise as a devoted companion, masterful huntswoman, and astute political advisor. Nur Mahal soon eclipsed Junkyard's many other wives. Her rise to power was especially unusual since she and Junkyard had no children. Still, Junkyard became ever more personally devoted to Nur Mahal, elevating her title to Nur Jahan, meaning light of the world. More than any other Mughal empress, Nur Jahan prominently participated in public events. With Junkyard's approval, she issued imperial orders and minted coins. She conducted diplomacy. Further, she sought to perpetuate her power by determining the imperial succession. Junkyard and Nur Jahan initially favored his third son by a different wife, whom they married to Nur Jahan's niece. They honored him with the royal title Shah Jahan, King of the World, and gave him command over the imperial armies in the strategic Deccan region of central India. Junkyard wrote, quote, "My consideration for this son is so unbounded that I would do anything to please him. He has accomplished to my satisfaction everything that he has set his hand to." Close quote. When Shah Jahan achieved a military victory, Nur Jahan hosted the celebration feast for him. Gradually, Junkyard weakened from his long-standing alcohol and drug addictions. From 1620 onward, he traveled almost every spring to Kashmir, where he spent the summer savoring its cool mountain climate, far removed from the heat and politics of North India. Nur Jahan nursed Jahangir devotedly. However, as a contemporary historian criticized, quote, she gradually acquired such unbounded influence over His Majesty's mind that she seized the reins of government and abrogated to herself the supreme civil and financial administration of the realm, ruling with absolute authority until the conclusion of his reign. Up to that point, Jahangir's relations with the Safavid Empire of Iran had largely continued through competitive diplomacy rather than warfare. However, ailing Jahangir's complacency was shattered in 1622 when a powerful Safavid expedition seized the strategic Afghan city of Kandahar from the inadequate Mughal garrison. A shocked Jahangir immediately ordered almost all his imperial forces diverted from their current deployments for a massive operation to retake Kandahar. In particular, he demanded that Shah Jahan bring his armies from the Deccan to lead this expedition, ordering, quote, "Wait on me with all possible speed with a victorious host and elephants of mountain hugeness and the numerous artillery, in order that the king of Persia might discover the results of breaking faith and of wrongdoing." Quote. Instead, Shah Jahan delayed, unwilling to journey to distant Kandahar, far from the heart of imperial politics. His non-compliance antagonized Jahangir, who proclaimed that, quote, "Shah Jahan was unworthy of all the favors and cherishing I had bestowed on him, and his brain had gone wrong." Despite Shah Jahan's superior military reputation, he lost repeatedly against stronger imperial armies. Each time, his status as an imperial prince and possible next emperor enabled him to gather more forces, only to be defeated again. Finally, Shah Jahan negotiated a submissive truce, sending his sons to Nur Jahan as hostages and agreeing to stay away from the imperial court. After the ailing emperor's final visit to Kashmir, he died in 1627. This deprived Nur Jahan of her strongest claim to imperial authority, that is, acting in Jahangir's name. Meanwhile, Shah Jahan and his supporters defeated, imprisoned, blinded, and then executed his remaining brothers and all other possible heirs. But Shah Jahan allowed Nur Jahan to withdraw quietly from imperial politics. After fleeing imperial armies for 6 years, suddenly victorious Shah Jahan seized the throne in 1628. He then proceeded to reshape the imperial court and empire over his three-decade-long rule. Shah Jahan determined to lavishly display his own imperial glory. He soon commissioned the uniquely brilliant golden peacock throne, a raised platform under a high canopy surmounted by ornamental peacock figures, everything thickly gem-encrusted. It took 7 years to accumulate the vast amounts of bullion and precious stones to craft a throne that Shah Jahan considered worthy of his reign. Over the next century, all who saw or heard of it were awed with Mughal magnificence. Shah Jahan identified strongly with his Sunni Muslim Central Asian ancestors. Indeed, he always devoutly performed the required 5 daily prayers and the month-long fast during Ramadan. Although Jahangir had compelled him to start drinking wine at age 24, Shah Jahan repudiated the practice of this at 30. This distinguished him from his many alcoholic relatives. He favored orthodox Sunni officials and scholars and generally enforced the Sharia more than his predecessors had. But he also respected the Shiism of his favorite wife, Mumtaz Mahal, and his numerous other Iranian officials. Shah Jahan's biological mother was a Hindu Rajput. He employed Rajputs extensively as generals and warriors, including on several imperial expeditions into distant Central Asia. However, he gave Rajputs no high appointments in his central administration and only one governorship. Further, he strongly condemned marriages in which either spouse left Islam for Hinduism. Still, while his armies destroyed the Hindu temples of defeated enemies and forbade the construction of new ones, these were largely punitive political policies to punish his Hindu enemies rather than religiously motivated attacks against Hinduism per se. Overall, Shah Jahan made his court more gloriously stately. His demeanor remained grave, solemn, and elevated. He sought to bind courtiers and officials to him, not through discipleship, as had Akbar and Jahangir, but rather through formal court rituals and lifelong loyal service. Shah Jahan also asserted control over his reign's official histories. Unlike predecessors who had personally written their own memoirs, Shah Jahan instead closely supervised the series of historians he commissioned to compile his massive official regnal chronicle, the Padshahnama. Shah Jahan had drafts regularly read out to him for his correction or elaboration. In the 10th year of his reign, Shah Jahan changed from his grandfather Akbar's solar calendar to the Orthodox Islamic calendar's lunar dating system. This change required retroactive recalibration of the imperial revenue and other official records. Under his close supervision, Shah Jahan's painting atelier reflected his formalistic taste for polished static scenes, elaborately displaying his imperial power. His commissioned portraits present him in majestic full profile with a halo. Non-imperial paintings during his reign showed much innovation, but his official imperial artists more deliberately emphasized the stability and gravity of events, even festivities like royal weddings and celebrations. War scenes showed not Shah Jahan fighting, but rather his generals enacting the ever-victorious orders of their distant but commanding emperor. In court scenes, Shah Jahan had each courtier accurately painted as an individual in profile, but not interacting with each other. Rather, everyone appeared focused on him seated on the peacock throne. This reflected his court's heightened decorum. Courtiers stood for hours, not speaking or moving without permission. Many carried elegant canes to lean on during these prolonged twice-daily formal audiences. Imperial artists also widely incorporated select European motifs and techniques, thereby suggesting the emperor's lofty power through Christian iconography as well. Advancing his commitment to glorifying his reign, Shah Jahan personally supervised most major imperial building projects and periodically inspected their progress. In particular, he deeply engaged himself in the design and construction of the tomb in Agra of his favorite wife, Mumtaz Mahal. Shah Jahan had daughters by his first and third wives, and he gave these women folk honored places in his imperial harem. But he remained devoted to his second wife, Mumtaz Mahal, from their marriage until her death and afterwards. When Shah Jahan succeeded as emperor, Mumtaz Mahal had already borne him 11 children. Only 3 years into his reign, Mumtaz Mahal died at age 38 while giving birth to their 14th child. Grieving Shah Jahan had her buried in a tomb that has been celebrated globally as the Taj Mahal. Selecting a site on the Jumna River, Shah Jahan ordered his builders to construct this most distinctive of all Mughal garden tombs, a vast mausoleum with a dome and four detached minarets. Unlike many Mughal mausoleum mosques, which are at the center of the garden, this tomb stands at the north end overlooking the river. Earlier tombs for the Mughal Empire and for its high officials customarily had used red sandstone, but this tomb had a fully white marble exterior, a style which had hitherto generally been reserved for holy men's shrines. Both the exterior and interior expansively used inlaid semi-precious stones. He selected the Quranic verses inscribed extensively in elegant calligraphy on its walls. He supervised closely, attending most years during the decade of its construction to commemorate Mumtaz Mahal's death anniversary and to inspect progress. By the time of its completion, this tomb garden had cost a vast amount, but only half the peacock throne's costs. For nearly four centuries, the Taj Mahal has stood as an architectural masterpiece, famous worldwide for the technology of its construction, and even more for the quality of its workmanship and the exquisite balance of proportion in its forms. After this tomb's construction, Shah Jahan ordered the huge number of skilled builders and workmen to migrate to Delhi in 1639. There he commissioned his entirely new imperial capital, Shah Jahanabad. This city had an imposing red sandstone-walled citadel, popularly known as the Red Fort, overlooking the Jumna River. It was designed for defense as well as to enclose the imperial palace complex. Perfumed water canals extended throughout, occasionally cascading over illuminated falls. The separate structures for dwelling, administration, and pleasure were mostly constructed with interior and exterior walls of white marble or stucco burnished to appear to be marble, often with highly ornate semi-precious stone inlays. Some glazed tiles depicted European-style images of jointly Quranic and biblical people and angels. Near the Red Fort, and also of red sandstone, Shah Jahan constructed the Jama Masjid, the largest mosque in India at that time. In 1653, he had Shah Jahanabad's city walls, which were initially brick and mud, faced with red sandstone. Within the city walls, imperial princes and officials built mansions surrounded by their workshops and their attendants' homes, forming distinctive neighborhoods. Courtiers and leading imperial women sponsored additional mosques and pleasure gardens within and without the city. Throughout, imperial hydraulic engineers constructed elaborate and efficient water supply and sewage systems. Plentiful potable water came from the wells in each neighborhood and from the Jumna River, either raised by Persian water wheels or channeled from upstream by canals. This system also provided for wet carriage sewage into the Jumna downstream of the city. Since most waste was organic and the city's human population was only in the tens of thousands, the river healthfully absorbed it. Surrounding market gardens received human and animal dry carriage sewage as fertilizer and produced vegetables for the inhabitants. Meanwhile, the empire faced challenges. Various local rulers and landholders within the empire paid tribute or taxes only under compulsion. Rebellions erupted whenever imperial armies were committed elsewhere. Prominent rebels were eventually punished by superior military force, but most who begged forgiveness were graciously pardoned and reinstated by Shah Jahan. This often produced a moral hazard, a recurring pattern of revived rebellions alternating with repeated forgiveness. Evoking his family's own origins, Shah Jahan orient himself culturally and politically towards Central Asia. From 1646 onward, he sent substantial armies to conquer there. However, these expeditions gained the empire virtually nothing. Instead, these Central Asian campaigns cost the empire substantial losses in manpower and prestige. Plus, they cost more than double Shah Jahan's financial expenses on his entire building program, including the Peacock Throne, Taj Mahal, and capital city of Shah Jahanabad. Like his predecessors, Shah Jahan wanted, but failed, to delay the succession struggle until after his own death, but also to control his legacy. He tried to bequeath the empire intact to his eldest son, Darshakoh, but also to protect his three other sons. All four brothers were the children of the late Mumtaz Mahal. Shah Jahan also kept his eldest child and favorite daughter, Jahanara Begum, near him. Upon the death of her mother, Mumtaz Mahal, Shah Jahan gave half her huge wealth to the 17-year-old Jahanara. The other half was divided among her siblings. Jahanara remained unmarried, led the harem, and managed the imperial household, despite the fact that Shah Jahan had two living wives. In 1644, Jahanara's delicate perfumed clothing accidentally caught fire. Two of her maids died extinguishing the blaze, and Jahanara suffered life-threatening burns. Shah Jahan personally tended her and, on her recovery, distributed her weight in gold as charity. With her own funds, Jahanara bestowed much patronage, commissioning gardens and mosques in Jahanabad and Kashmir. Combining her religious and literary commitments, she had herself initiated into two Sufi orders and wrote accounts of their leading saints. Like Shah Jahan, she strongly supported Dara, her nearest younger full brother, who shared many of her inclinations. Dara also had himself initiated into a Sufi order, and he wrote 5 works on Sufism. He sought the universal truth of Islam, including through esoteric Indic religions. He wrote a comparative study of Islamic and Indic mysticism entitled The Meeting Place of the Two Oceans. Further, he gathered fellow seekers into his household and supervised the translations into Persian of over 50 major Indic religious works, including the Bhagavad Gita and some Brahmanic texts, collectively called the Siri Akbar, the Greatest Mystery. From this title and Dara's sincere spiritual searching beyond the Islamic tradition alone, many commentators identify him with his great-grandfather Akbar. But neither Shah Jahan nor Dara could secure his succession in the deadly competition against his brothers. The emperor kept Dara near him, but deployed his 3 other sons as governors and commanders throughout his empire. This gave them administrative and military experience and enabled them to build their own factions. Over time, Shah Jahan's 3rd son, Prince Aurangzeb, later known as Emperor Alamgir, proved most successful. While governing in the Deccan, Aurangzeb assembled and commanded the empire's most powerful and battle-hardened armies. The actual succession crisis began prematurely, when Shah Jahan suffered a serious intestinal disorder in September 1657. While disabled, he entrusted rule to Dara. Although Shah Jahan recovered by November, the 3 younger sons had already agreed to unite against Dara. But each of the 3 also declared himself emperor. Driving onward, Aurangzeb imprisoned Shah Jahan in Agra and then defeated and executed his brothers and their main supporters, including his own eldest son. Thus, the pattern begun with Shah Jahan's accession recurred at the end of his reign. Only 1 imperial prince survived the bloody succession war. However, this time, the former emperor remained alive. For nearly 8 years, Aurangzeb kept Shah Jahan imprisoned in Agra, bereft of any significant support among officials or his subjects until his death at age 74 from natural causes. Even then, Aurangzeb allowed little ceremony for his internment next to Mumtaz Mahal. Already firmly enthroned and in control, Aurangzeb would rule for 5 decades. But there were rising rival empires, as we'll discuss in the next lecture.